Let's welcome Jack Lattimore to do the honours in our last Indigenous update. Jack has changed jobs since we last spoke. He was at SBSNITV, but now he's Indigenous Affairs journalist for The Age, and Jack's going to reflect on the role of Indigenous journalism for us if we have time. But Jack, first of all, we must talk about the death in the family, and that old cliche about an outpouring of grief is not only justified but an understatement, an overwhelming response.
Yeah, that's right, Philip, and good to speak to you again after a while. That's right, and of course we're referring to the passing of David Dalignil. Now, I'm not sure if I got the pronunciation right because I don't speak Yolngu, but the man himself, as you said, widespread outpouring of grief nationally, internationally. And, yeah, just one of those moments. I was saying earlier that it kind of reminds me a little bit of when Anthony Bourdain suddenly died, and just people, you know, really touched people, his life's work, what he represented in himself. And I think David very much more so.
He was much more than merely a fine, a wonderful dancer, of course, and a fine actor. There was a much greater resonance, a much greater depth to his life, other than, you know, Storm Boy and Crocodile Dundee and Rabbit Proof Fence. There was an almost mystical connection between this bloke and Australia.
Seems to be, yeah. I remember I was born in mid-70s, and Walkabout came out a few years before I was born. I remember seeing it as a young fella, and just, yeah, those scenes with him in it just were very haunting. And also Storm Boy, that dance scene in that, same sort of thing, just carried spirituality with him at a time also where Aboriginal culture and Aboriginal people themselves weren't as well, weren't celebrated at all. We're still experiencing the sorts of you know, racist policies were in place around that time, and David himself, in order to travel to film festivals and screenings and different things like that, had to obtain permission to do so in the early days. So yeah, his professional life spanned that period of time where racist and discriminatory policies were still in place.
As well as a widespread mourning in Indigenous communities, Jack, there must be an immense sense of pride because he's become such an important cultural figure.
Yeah, there is. There has been. Just on our social media feeds, we've pretty much all got those these days, haven't we? You see people, you know, look, prominent names, Gary Foley, for example. He recalled watching or waking up one evening when he was up there north and finding David dancing by a campfire and being quite moved by that. And everyone that that I've seen posting about it has just been remarking upon how when he entered the room he had a natural presence about him, a gravitas, and that carried forth even more in the way he moved.
Jack, he also had, and I know this from personal contact, an immense sense of humour.
I'm told he did. Unfortunately, I never met the man, but
What I'm saying is there was no self-importance. You know, he was absolutely a delight. Yeah. Yep. Well, Jack, as we celebrate one representative of Indigenous culture, the battle to save pieces of cultural importance continues. A petition presented outside federal parliament today. Tell us about it.
Well, is this the open letter? We had an open letter against the WA, supposed cultural heritage protection. 146 people signed this open letter, and they're just asking the WA government to withdraw it from Parliament. The thinking is that they're trying to rush it through, and the problem that these people and many, many more have with it is that it doesn't really do much to address some of the issues that saw the destruction from Juukan Gorge, for example, but other and many other incidences of cultural heritage destruction in that state. So, yeah, essentially the bill, the government retains ultimate decision-making powers, and it limits appeal options, which isn't a great sort of progression on from what was in place beforehand that allowed the destruction of Juukan Gorge under Section 20s. And, of course, with the Way Forward report that was released not so long ago, a couple of months, which was that Senate inquiry headed up by Warren Entsch, that report called on the WA government specifically to improve its heritage protections up to an acceptable standard. This bill doesn't do that. So we see almost 150 prominent names again put their name to this letter, and we're talking people like Marsh Langton, Megan Davis was one, Kato Muir, former WA Premier Carmen Lawrence put a name on there. There's a whole heap of them. The letter's out there. You go and have a look for yourself. But, yeah, they're all saying that the bill entrenches systemic discrimination against the state's Aboriginal people in not being co-designed and not being consultative with them enough.
Okay, Jack. Now, there was, as I said, some good news out of Federal Parliament today, and that is that the voter identity laws won't be proceeding at this stage. Well, thank heavens for that, because that was going to have a very serious impact on Indigenous people.
It was, yeah. And I still don't quite understand why there was this push to introduce it.
Well, it was very Trumpian in approach, wasn't it?
It seemed to be imported from over there. We've got a little bit of that going on at the moment. But, yeah, essentially it was to reduce the possibility that people would front up two or three or four times, I imagine, to vote. And I don't know, but the sausages just aren't that good.
Well, even in the US, the number of fraudulent votes are infinitesimally small. You know, you're talking about, you know, fourth decimal points, and there's no evidence of it being significant here.
No evidence of it being significant, quite the opposite. I've heard so much over so many years about the difficulty of getting Aboriginal people, particularly in remote areas, you know, to just turn up and vote, or they want to vote and aren't able to get to the ballot. So, yeah, and there's also the whole issue around Australian Bureau of Statistics. Some of their data always faces difficulties and challenges when it goes into regional remote areas.
Jack, I want you to tell me about blackfishing. What is it? I know you've been doing some important work with your colleagues at The Age about right-wing extremism and this phenomenon.
Yeah, well, blackfishing, in short, now, this is my take on it, so I'll probably get someone pulling me up and saying I've got it wrong, but it sort of derives from catfishing, which is that practice, that weird practice that people have where they convince somebody online that they are something that they are actually not. Develop relationships. Sometimes these relationships go for, you know, years. And eventually they get found out, usually through a movie or a television program that might be on American Music, you know, a television channel, that, you know, they're not who they thought they were. People ends in tears. Blackfishing is a lot like that. It's when movements, well, one incidence of it is when movements essentially drape themselves in the colours of the Koori flag. And otherwise present themselves as having strong First Nations support for the agenda that they're pushing, when in fact they either don't at all or it's so minuscule. But, yeah, it's very coordinated. There's been a lot of organising by you know, far-right or alt-right groups that are, you know, basically driving a lot of the freedom rally type stuff down here in Victoria and elsewhere, to, you know, present themselves as though they've got all of this support, which they don't.
Well, one of them is an outfit called Reignite Democracy, and I know you've had a look at that.
Yeah, they were really strong on a social media platform called Telegram, which is encrypted end-to-end user, something that we're possibly more familiar with in WhatsApp and Signal and things like that. Telegram's the preferred one for a lot of these alt-right groups. And Reignite Democracy is one that has a fairly large following or fan base, 65,000 it was when we last checked. And they're aligned with far-right groups, including LAD Society, but also bridges across to some political parties and some individuals that we have heard a lot from via text.
Jack, finally, you've been writing a bit about the business of being a journalist, which is unusual in itself. But what did you feel? Why do you feel there needs to be more understanding?
Well, I've written recently about it because former Age editor Michael Gwender wrote something for The Age. The Age itself hasn't been really strong in terms of Indigenous representation in the past. I think I'm the first Aboriginal Affairs journalist that it's ever had, and the first Aboriginal journalist since I think it was, a handful of years ago, half a dozen or something like that. And, they got Michael Gwender to write about some of the thinking that was in place not so long ago. So I was kind of responding to that and pointing out that there's always been a lot of black journalists and journalism going on. It's just that people have had to clear the cotton wool out of their ears to hear it.
But, of course, in the past you've worked for a lot of black media where the stories are targeted for an Indigenous audience. Now you've got to talk to everyone.
It's very weird, Philip. I don't know how well I'm doing it, but I think I'm picking up great skills, and that's important as well as bringing the sorts of skills that I've acquired elsewhere across to tell really important stories to predominantly white audiences. So.
Well, you've also got to educate your colleagues, I guess, but that's something you'll have to do with characteristic subtlety, and that's what I always think about you, Jack. You're characteristically subtle. Indigenous Affairs journalist at The Age, the marvellous Jack Lattimore. Thanks for all your contributions to the program this year.